This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. It's my intention over the next couple of weeks to give you some Olympic snippets each morning. Today is particularly difficult with the hangover from the Machdal Shams massacre that took place on Saturday. But I am going to give some quick updates about Israeli athletes in the Olympic Games and some interesting things that have been happening over the last few days. First of all, today is quite an exciting day because we have Nastia Gorbenko, who is competing in the 400 meter individual medley, and she is considered a great medal hope for that event. She will swim in the heats this morning and the final will be tonight. So we're very, very much hoping that Israel might still earn its first medal today. She did qualify for the semifinals yesterday in the women's 100 meters breaststroke, but she decided to withdraw from that semifinal and to concentrate her efforts on the individual medley, which is clearly her strength. She's a very good all-rounder. So good luck to Nastia Gorbenko, and let's hope that she will bring home some medal for Israel, which we haven't managed to earn yet. There have been some competitors in the judo yesterday. Geffen Primor was eliminated in the repechage round just before the bronze medal bout, and she was very upset about that. She was within reaching distance of a bronze medal fight. Unfortunately, that wasn't to be. Artem Dolgopiat is the Olympic reigning champion for the floor exercise, having earned a gold medal in Tokyo. His performance on Saturday was really not up to his usual standard. There was some concern that he might not make the final in the end, but even though he gave not his best performance and with a number of errors, he has made the final eight. That final, the gold medal competition, will take place on the coming Saturday. Let's hope that Artem will be able to up his game a little bit. Just another little interesting snippet is the fact that today Israel's Tor Butbul is due to compete in the 73-kilogram category of judo, and his first bout was due to be against an Algerian athlete, Redouan Driss. Well, Redouan Driss yesterday weighed in above the weight, so he's been disqualified from competing, which some consider to be just a diplomatic way of withdrawing from the competition. One could almost see him in the back, could envisage in our minds him sitting at the back trying to increase his weight before the weigh-in in order to avoid having to compete against Tor Butbul. So Tor will have a walkover victory for the first round today, but he will continue on after that. Just an interesting one, another method of athletes managing to somehow avoid competing against Israeli athletes. And one would have thought that having qualified for the Olympic Games, this is like a pinnacle of an athlete's career. Why would you wish to throw your bout, having managed to achieve that much? Perhaps some of it is to do with the pressure from the regime. We'll never really know. So those are really the main highlights so far from Israel's Olympic performance. Oh, I should mention Anat Lelior, who is surfing in the competition in Tahiti. That's where the surfing competition is taking place. And she is through the first two rounds and will today, I think today the next round takes place. She will surf in the round of 16. So we are hopeful that she might do well there too.
Incredible. Of course, the big story is the attack by Hezbollah on Saturday, the repercussions, the fallout. Tell us what happened.
Well, this all took place in a town on the slopes of the Golan Heights called Majd al-Shams. Majd al-Shams is a Druze town, population around 12,000 people. It's always been a Druze town. The history of Majd al-Shams is not exactly clear, but what is clear about Majd al-Shams is that it was always a Druze town from the moment that it was set up. It was originally part of Syria. And in fact, the residents of Majd al-Shams were recruited originally during the War of Independence in 1948, apparently were willing to fight alongside Israeli forces, even though they were not quite sure which side of the border they really fell out on. And ultimately, they fought with the Arab forces in 1948, and they became part of Syria, an integrated part of Syria, between the period of 1948 and 1967. During the 1967 war, when Israel captured the Golan Heights area, Majd al-Shams was also one of those towns that was captured to Israeli side. And there was a little bit of controversy at that point about which citizens of Majd al-Shams and the neighboring villages would fall on the Syrian side and which would fall on the Israeli side. And there are numerous stories about families that were split along the border that was drawn in at the end of 1967, some on the Syrian side, some on the Israeli side. There was this great movie called The Syrian Bride, for those who've seen it, which was really a story centered around Majd al-Shams and how families were split across the border. When Majd al-Shams became part of Israel in 1967, the citizens were not very happy about being part of Israel, even though, as a general rule, our Druze citizens in Israel are very loyal to the state and they serve in the army, and there are numerous stories about how fantastic they are as citizens of Israel. Majd al-Shams is a little different because the citizens of Majd al-Shams didn't really buy in to the concept of being part of Israel. And even though Israel extended to them every right that every Israeli citizen has, they didn't accept that too gladly. And eventually in 1981, Israel actually annexed the Golan Heights and annexed Majd al-Shams and offered all the citizens of Majd al-Shams the opportunity to become Israeli citizens and to carry Israeli passports. As of now, my understanding is that only about 20% of the citizens of Majd al-Shams have taken up the opportunity to become Israeli citizens. They are all Israeli residents. They all have health care extended to them. They all have every right that every Israeli resident has. They are allowed to live anywhere in Israel and are allowed to move around freely, but only 20% of them have apparently taken up Israeli citizenship. And of course, that whole background story creates a little bit of controversy when we think about the events that happened on Saturday afternoon, when that Falak 1 missile, an Iranian manufactured missile, fell on the playground in Majd al-Shams, where a number of children were playing soccer in the neighboring field. And ultimately, unfortunately, 12 children aged between 10 and 20 were killed as a result of that missile falling. Many, many others were injured, some of them quite seriously. Many of them have been treated in the Rambam Hospital in Haifa in order to put them through surgeries and to try to treat their injuries. So the 12 children who were killed and whose funerals were held yesterday very, very emotionally is not the end of the story, because there's still many, many children and other residents of Majd al-Shams who remain injured as a result of that. And so the controversy rages because there are some questions as to whether Israel was really committed enough to protect the citizens of Majd al-Shams. Why is it that they weren't in bomb shelters when those sirens, when those missiles were falling? Why the sirens were not sufficient in order to get those children into the bomb shelter? We understand that there was a bomb shelter not too far from the playing ground. We understand that some of those children were on their way to the bomb shelter when that missile fell. And of course, then questions about Hezbollah, because of course, Hezbollah come out saying, oh, it wasn't us. And then Israel said, what do you mean it wasn't you? This is the name of the person who fired the missile, publicly naming the individual, and then showing the actual trajectory of the missile, exactly where it was fired from, exactly how it traveled, and exactly how it landed at that playground in Majd al-Shams. So there can be little doubt about the fact that this was fired by Hezbollah. We know the name of the guy who actually authorized firing it on one site that I saw. The writer of the site said he should kiss his mother goodbye because his name has been put out there. And it's unlikely that he's going to be seeing too many future days because, of course, his days are numbered. So the question now is, what next? And many of the citizens of Majd al-Shams are screaming at the Israeli government, saying this should be retaliated against and should be forceful. In the meantime, what's been very fascinating is that Lebanon and other citizens around the region have been sweating, waiting to see what Israel's response is going to be. All of the airlines have canceled their flights to Lebanon. We understand that Hezbollah have furiously been moving people away from critical areas in southern Lebanon, been moving supplies. They are clearly nervous about how Israel is going to respond. One writer has said, we love to see the sweating. We should allow them to sweat a little longer and not come up with a response. Let them be nervous. Let them be concerned about what it is that we might do. Others are saying the longer we take to respond, the weaker we look in the eyes of the people who fire that missile towards us. One thing is clear, however, is that Israel cannot allow this event just to go by without a significant response. The fact that it happens to have been in the Golan and the fact that it happens to have been a Druze town is of no consequence to this discussion. We will treat this event as if though there were Jews or Christians or Arabs or any other citizens of Israel involved. Nobody's different. And this is really an attack against sovereign Israel. And the response will come whenever it comes and in the form that it takes. In the meantime, the Security Cabinet yesterday authorized Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant to decide what to do and when to do it. So those two now have the right to make all decisions. In the meantime, Chief of General Staff Herzi Halevi has been to Majd al-Shams. He's visited the location. He's made some statements. He visited with the head of the Northern Command in order to assess the situation. And he claims that he has authorized the next actions that the IDF are going to be taking, whatever those might be. In the meantime, we've had drone attacks from Lebanon this morning, some of those which have been shot down. We understand that there was a drone attack carried out against an Israeli oil rig, the Karish, in the Mediterranean Sea. Also on Saturday, a drone which was shot down by Israeli Navy that could potentially have threatened the oil industry. So quite a lot of action going on. And of course, I'm sure you, Howard, and listeners out there have their views about should we be waiting and allowing people to sweat a little bit and then carrying out an attack in a more determined way, or should we be firing from the hip and showing that we are ready and that we don't need to wait and that we're going to come in straight away and show strength without any hesitation? That's the big question,
I guess it is. But my question around this is, how much interference has there been, or how much involvement do other allies like the United States have?
Well, there has been a lot of involvement. The French and the US in particular have been very active in trying to prevent Israel from carrying out a response which they determine might create some sort of a regional war. And interestingly, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that he thinks that a ceasefire in Gaza may well alleviate any further conflict on the northern border. We know that there are discussions in Rome, and in fact, the Israeli head of the Mossad, Dudu Barnea, has been traveling backwards and forwards to Rome to participate in those negotiations for a hostage release and a ceasefire. And Antony Blinken is of the view that that's the critical thing that will help to alleviate the problems in the north. But clearly, there is a lot of nervous tension, not only in Lebanon itself and on our border, but indeed in Washington and in Paris and in other capitals around the world. And also in Istanbul, where President Erdogan, the Turkish president, has made some very, very attacking statements, very combative statements about attacking Israel like he's done in other areas. So this has really created a lot of consternation, and there is concern that some sort of a regional conflict may result from Israel's retaliation.
And that is where we leave it. We'll keep an eye on this story and, of course, chat to Anthony Rock tomorrow morning at 7:45. Thank you, Anthony. I'm Howard Feldman. Good morning.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands.
Hi, it's Barry Cohen from the Blue Agency. Israel is currently facing one of its biggest challenges ever. All of Klal Yisrael is praying for the safety of our soldiers and the return of the hostages. We hope and pray that our soldiers and security forces will prevail and that they will all return home speedily and triumphant. We hold the hands of our clients and friends who have children serving in Tzahal, who are protecting Israel and Jews around the world. May Hashem protect us all.